Welcome to Late Night Poetry Jam on KKRN Community Radio. I am Pamela Spoto, poet and host.
In my heart, in my brain, on my tongue, behind my teeth. Behind my eyes, on my tongue, under my skin, in my heart. In my veins, under my skin, behind my teeth, on my tongue, on my tongue, on my tongue.
We are broadcasting from KKRN Community Radio in Round Mountain. We will host a bi-monthly poetry show the last Saturday of the month at 10 p.m. So here we go, Late Night Poetry Jam. And in the studio tonight, we have poet Susan Woolridge. Hello, Susan.
Hello, Pamela.
Hello, Doug.
Hello, Pamela.
Okay. Now I'm going to get down to business because I'm business-oriented right now. I'm really happy to have Susan Woolridge in the studio, and she is a poet as well as an author. And I have several of her books here right in front of me, and one is Poem Crazy, Freeing Your Life with Words, and we're going to be talking about that. I use this book in my creative writing class. Some of the exercises are just wonderful, and I don't mean only some of them, but I use some of them, and those are wonderful exercises. And I also have Bathing with Ants, a chapbook that Susan, hopefully, we can entice to read some poems out of.
Won't be hard.
And then also Fool's Gold, but I haven't read that, but I have a little information about that. And it's the title of the book is Fool's Gold, Making Something from Nothing and Freeing Your Creative Process. So those are the books that we're going to be looking at, and Susan's going to be reading. Usually, I interview our guest several weeks before we have our show. And so I drove to Chico to see Susan. And I knew Susan way in the past, and I hadn't seen you for, I don't know, 15 years. But I was thinking about your book, Poem Crazy, and it's such a wonderful book. And I thought, I wonder if Susan is available, you know, to do a radio show on poetry. And sure enough, she was. And so we decided to meet at the Tin Roof, and I had never been there before. And it was wonderful, this bakery and coffee house in Chico. And as we were talking, I realized that, and this is wonderful too, is that we are very different in terms of how we approach, let's say, doing a show. And I'm the organizer and the planner, and I like things in order, and I'm a double Scorpio. And Susan is this free spirit, and she said sometimes in her mind this little voice appears that says, don't prepare, you know, don't prepare. And she said, I just love winging it. So I said, okay, that's fine. I'm going to stretch myself, and we are going to do a little winging it. However, I did make some notes, and I thought that we would begin with one of her poems in the chapbook. And the title is so intriguing to me, and it's called God Likes Sex.
I'm not surprised that Pamela chose that one. And I sort of snuck it in the book because I work a lot with children, and so didn't want to shock them too much with my chapbook. But here it goes. God Likes Sex, I say, stepping on the accelerator, remembering our bodies in the shower. God loves children. When we make love, I see light. I speed past the deserted house with bushes in the kitchen, tumbleweed beds, air, mice, moss roof, red-winged blackbirds. When can I move in?
Thank you. Now, right across the page from that, and I thought that went very well together. And could we get you to read Mating with Geese?
Of course, Pamela. You know, I had a long-term relationship with Lone Star Road, which is just outside of Chico. My marriage was falling apart, and my most romantic partner was this road, Lone Star. And I have many poems to Lone Star Road. And so this one took place on Lone Star, but this was about a slightly different relationship, Mating with Geese. It was on Lone Star Road, in full view of the Sutter Buttes, that I mated with geese. Squadrons rushed over me in waves, honking, flooding me with goose lust, teasing what was left of me, wrapped in denim, draped over my Honda's hood. I was smitten, lost as Lita, with relentless wings pulsing over me and the soaking road. Now I'm weaving a great straw and grapevine nest near the compost by the wild fig, sage, and collapsing poke beside our shed.
That's lovely. And
you went right for the sexy ones, didn't you, girl?
I did, and why did I do that? No, never mind. I was flipping through the book, and I thought, oh, what an intriguing title. Yes, I did. I went right for the sex.
I love it.
But I also, another poem in the chat book that I want to get to, and then I would like to talk to you a little bit more about who you are, is The Latest Excuses. And that was the poem that that first caught my eye. And I was reading that, and I just went, that is an amazing poem. And so maybe we could talk just a little bit before you read that. The way I took that was, sometimes someone will ask me to do something and, and I don't want to do it. And so I come up with various excuses of why, I can't do that particular thing, whether it's a lover or a friend or whoever it might be. Now, and I don't know what was, inspiring you when you wrote this, but this poem just grabs me.
Thank you, sweetheart. You know, it does come from wanting to do things sideways. I have that Cancer rising. I come in sideways. And I used to tell my children they could insult each other as much as they wanted if they did it in a creative way, like, oh, you fluorescent light with ants crawling in it. Oh, you window that's broken on the corner. You know, they had to use a visual image. And so I kind of took that all the way with my excuses. And it was actually written to a person who's no longer alive, I will not mention the name, who was always getting me into situations and making me feel guilty. And I wrote this poem because, you're right, I was asked to do something I didn't want to do, like be a friend of someone I couldn't be a friend with, and terrible situation. So the poem came out this way. I'm sorry, but you see I'm pulling foxtails from the dog's deep toes. I have chicken pox, perplexia, visiting ants. There are unexpected, unpicked, ripening apricots, eggs to imagine gathering. I must wax the bananas, patch spider webs, rearrange lily pads, re-roof the shed, re-shed the cat, dye fur pink and wear it lightly over blue angora shoulders. I'm breaking up, making up. I'm at the Australian movie's last late showing. I'm toying with departure, packing, unpacking, putting off sleep, leaving for the ocean, running out to sea. And still I must embalm the macaws, defoliate the lamb's quarter, reseed the labyrinth, weed the pasta patch, winterize the milkweed, fumigate the basement of the baby blue body shop, celebrate the watermelons, confiscate your holding pattern, navigate our dream machine, consecrate the found skulls clacking in the high wind, wash the twitching moon quarter tilting in the sky with the intermittent help of the green dyspeptic moon man. I must hug the oldest trees, lug the silver chalice from the late spring snows, and dwell in my forest of inchling ginkgos.
Thank you.
I kind of like that word twilting better than tilting, you know? Twilting, it's got wilting in it.
Well, I get caught on that line, I must embalm the macaws. I mean, what a great line. No, I can't do anything tonight. I must embalm the macaws. Defoliate the lamb's quarter.
I like to go farther and farther out. It tends to be the... There's a certain kind of poem I write when I'm driving, and I might have written this one in the car, and I just get farther and farther out, and my excuses got wilder and wilder, and it's so much fun. I realize I did that in a recent poem. I did it in a poem about colors, and I just like to play, I think is what it amounts to. And I encourage people not to take writing quite so seriously, and we all like to laugh.
So. Yes, laugh more.
Yeah, and we did have a macaw that lived next door that would, in the middle of the night, have you ever heard a macaw? I don't want to do it on the radio. I'm afraid I'll scare away all the listeners. Maybe I'll turn my head and do my macaw imitation.
Go ahead.
I mean, really, they're and they do it at 4 in the morning. So I had visions of embalming that macaw.
Doug, do you have a macaw?
Uh-oh.
No, we have a pale-headed Rosella that is polite enough when covered at night to be quiet.
Okay, yes.
It's an Australian parrot, but it's very noisy. Not as loud as a macaw.
Yeah.
It is noisy. I remember, Susan, a long time ago that you had told me, or you had told a group, and I was in that group at that time. I don't really remember why we were meeting, but a group of people were meeting, and you had said that you wrote poetry while you were driving, and I just went, driving and writing, you know, it was like, I couldn't imagine it because I was trying to figure out when did I write poems? Probably when I was walking and the poems would come and they would move around in my head. But it was very, very interesting because when I got the job at Shasta College, I would drive from Chico to Shasta College before I moved up, and I started writing in the car.
Yes.
And then when I was driving to Petaluma, this 440-mile round trip, and I would write. I would miss turnoffs, but I would have my yellow notepaper. Maybe I shouldn't say this, but I would write. I would drive and write because it was such a focused time that and it was quiet and I was driving, and there was something about that rhythm that was really inspiring, and some of my best poems are off the road poems or
mine
on the
too.
Road on
mm-hmm.
the road poems. You know, I wanted to read this. This is a little paragraph about your book Fool's Gold, and I thought maybe we could kind of step back and we could talk about this a little bit, because when I talked with you at the Tin Roof, we got into these incredible conversations, from meditation to alternative healing to writing poetry to to men. and other things. And it was very, very fascinating. And the conversation just went in these various directions. And I think this paragraph touches on that in terms of writing. And so what this says is, and it's a quote, "I'm gradually learning that," by the way, I should say this is from a chapter in Fool's Gold called Freeing the Creek. I'm gradually learning that, paradoxically, it's the blunderings, giving ups, breakdowns, in spite ofs, chance encounters, letting goes, and mess-ups that have led to most of the creativity in my life. Not the enlightened inspiration, and certainly not feeling in control. It's the listenings, buzz hums, the falling, leaping down the rabbit hole, the stepping through the looking glass, barefoot with no suitcase in new territory. And I was wondering if you could possibly talk about that a little bit. Would it be as, you know, I'm not sure, would it be as, on one level, I'm going, oh, it's that struggle in my life that I can reach in, which is true in the past, that where I can just get, I get really obsessed when I'm in that, and then I can write. It's not from this how did you say it, the enlightened inspiration. It's being in the middle of something that is just taking me over, and then I tend to write more.
Yes, which could lead to the enlightened inspiration, but I have found, especially because most of my teaching that has really meant something to me has been with, quote, at-risk people. And there are so many at-risk people, including us, all of us, but working, say, in the juvenile hall or working with kids in alternative schools. And I never would have been able to reach those kids had it not been for my personal breakdowns. In fact, I told Pamela, and I more and more I'm coming right out and saying this because I think there's been enough years that have come between me and this event that I'm no longer considered stark raving crazy, but I was locked up as a 20-year-old. I had a psychotic break, and at I think a friend has told me since it was a spiritual crisis, and we don't see it that way for people. We don't understand that most breakdowns are spiritual emergencies that need to be treated the way they would be in other cultures. The Africans bring people together and drum around them, and we lock people up. But the great experience about being locked up and completely failing everyone, completely letting go of my idea of who I was, and forced my parents to drop all expectations of me. My dad was a hotshot professor, and I was supposed to be an academic, and he was at the University of Chicago, and pretty much their expectations were reduced to having me be relatively sane. So that was an unbelievably, incredibly positive experience that at the time was a disaster. And it has allowed me to have a connection and a bridge to kids and to people who have been troubled. And so when I go in the juvenile hall and I tell them that I've been locked up too and I was committed somewhere against my will, they open. They start to trust me. And had I known at the time that it would have even led to the deepest work that I've done, I would have even been happier about this total breakdown. You know, often it's those edgy breakdowns. The Kabbalah says that the spheres have to be shattered in order to really, truly be made whole. And I've experienced that.
I want to remind the audience, if you are just tuning in, you are listening to Late Night Poetry Jam on KKRN. I am Pamela Spoto in the studio, along with Doug Bennett, who is our producer, and poet Susan Woolridge. And we're so lucky to have Susan with us here. And before our break, Susan was talking about a break of sorts. And she had mentioned that particular situation, and what I call it, I mean, I don't want to use the wrong words here. Would I call it an emotional break? A spiritual break, a psychic break?
Every type of possible break.
You broke.
I broke.
and you were, and your words were you were locked up for a
months.
Period.
Yeah, it's the best thing that ever happened to me. Though,
and the reason that I'm bringing this back up is, yes, a couple of reasons. One is that sometimes those things are hidden. We don't want to talk about them. There's something, you know, oh my goodness, there's a label that's placed on a person. But out of those places, wonderful transformations can happen. And I think that you alluded to that what came out of that was wonderfully positive. Maybe you didn't know it at the very time being in the middle of it, but what transpired after that was transformational. But you also said one thing it does and did is allow you to go into, for example, and I know that you've done poets in the schools and you've done numerous poetry readings, but you also worked in juvenile hall and going in and doing writing and doing poetry with the young people there, the inmates. And I want to call them, I don't want to label them, you know.
Oh, and that's where I'd love to toss in that one of the kids in there named Flint labeled them, and it's a chapter in Poem Crazy, Misfits Castle of Lightning.
Ooh.
That's the juvenile hall.
And they're wonderful words. They're wonderful words that we can, and you had mentioned the word play, that we can play with. And the more words we have, the more play we can do. And so what I wanted to do is I wanted to go to Poem Crazy for a little bit here, because I do use this in my creative writing class, I think, as I mentioned. But I also wanted to read what Anne Lamont, and I love Anne Lamont, had to say about your book, Poem Crazy. And she writes, Poem Crazy is a wonderful book, smart, wide-eyed, joyful, helpful, inspiring. You're going to love it and love writing poetry more for having read it. And I thought that was really lovely. Now I'm going to prepare Doug that I'm going to ask him a couple of questions. And what I do during and I want to talk a little bit about these questions because it leads to these wonderful short lined poems that were written by students in some of your students in juvenile hall. So these are a series of questions, and I'm just going to read a couple, and then I'm going to ask Doug specifically. But for example, and the students can really get into this. For example, what shape would I be? What sound? What animal? What song? What number? What car? What piece of furniture? What food? What place? And at the very end, you have two questions. What's something I'm afraid of? What's the word hiding behind my eyes? So I'm going to ask Doug, what animal would you be if you were an animal?
Can I take the fifth? I don't want to be... I was praying inmate there for a while. I've always liked the idea of the tiger.
The tiger. And as a matter of fact, I know you have written a poem about a tiger. What about, and I know I'm kind of putting you on the spot here, but if you were going to be a piece of furniture, I had a student one time tell me he was a king-sized bed. But
he's bragging.
Do you see yourself as a piece of furniture? I mean, could you be a piece of furniture?
Well, it would have to be more of an animate type. How about a treadmill?
Oh.
No, that wouldn't be a piece of furniture.
Well, it could be because those often appear in our front rooms.
Maybe a writing desk. I don't know.
Oh, and then maybe you could choose between one of these two. If you were a sound or a food, what sound or food might you be?
Well, I'd be chocolate pudding. There's no doubt about it.
Oh, chocolate pudding. You do like chocolate.
Oh, yeah.
So after the students answer these, then... Susan, you suggest that we put down the words and we preface it or we end it with "I am," and it's a really wonderful way to get creativity happening. And can I read this?
I just would like to add to something before you read that, because the questions are very important. But what led to that poem, and what many of those words, where they came from, were what I call a word pool.
Yes.
And word tickets.
Yes.
We had come up with some of the words that are used in that poem, like collide and slam. I have kids steal words. And increasingly what I do that's not in Poem Crazy is I hand out books of poems, and as we're walking into the workshop, I have people steal words from books of poems, and they feel those words are valid. They don't have to worry about spelling them. Excuse me. So numbers of those words were actually stolen or came from a word pool. It's not as if the kids have this vocabulary.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wanted to add that, because otherwise that was going to be a little bit misleading. So go ahead from there. Yeah.
And see, I don't usually do the that portion in class, but it's an absolutely wonderful idea coming up with these words. And as I see right here in front of me, I see a little bag of tickets, and I bet there are words written on those. So why don't you pull one of those out, or a couple of those out?
Let's see. This one says domestic crisis. This one says discovers a world of reply. Here we have England, business, sweeps. I tend to go for nouns and verbs my elbow, which is a noun verb. And I write a lot about noun verbs in Fool's Gold. And here's snow goose. And so the kids are expanded. We all have a tendency to go in little circles in our head with the words that we use. And we limit ourselves to those words. And so I make a major effort to expand their word pool.
Right.
And we steal words, we put them on the board and share them, and I hand out the word tickets. And so that's where this poem came from.
So I'm going to read this poem now, and it was written by a young man named David in juvenile hall. And here it goes. I'm a brown gangster colliding with death, a rose slamming love with hate. And that's always moved me. Or this one on the other page, I'm a weird mad man, full moon me. And full moon me,
this was a fourth grader.
That's wonderful. Now, I'm going to share with you a three-line poem that I wrote from this exercise. Is that okay?
Certainly. I'd love to hear it.
Okay. A wild black stallion kicks the sky, hooves to heaven, I am.
I love the way you turned it around. It's great.
And I had a Latina student in class write, I'm a jalapeno pepper, hot, hot, hot. And so, it was really...
Fabulous.
These were really inspiring to the students. So where we're going to go now, if it's okay, is to your book, Fool's Gold.
Yes.
And I think you're going to read or share some information from that, and also following that to read just a series of your poems. And that would be wonderful.
I would love that. And I was going to go to a chapter excuse me, I always get a little hoarse when I'm talking, a chapter called Nichta Luludi, Would You Be Willing? And Nichta Luludi is the Greek word for night flower. And I went into the juvenile hall, maybe 3 or 4 years ago, and I, for some reason, had read Odysseus Aletus. He went hiding into the garden of night flowers. And I'd been in Greece, and that word Nichta Luludi just stuck with me, the beauty of it, night flower. And I put it on the board, and there was a boy in that workshop, and I think I'll tell you his true name. His name was Trey, and he sobbed through the entire first workshop. He was not able to write. He just sobbed. And the second session, when he saw that I was not putting people on the spot, there was no judgment, no criticism, he began to participate. But the first thing he said is, put that word back on the board, Nichta, whatever it is. And so we put Nichta Luludi back on the board. He needed that word. He was a kid who had been going at night on his bicycle, robbing people in the park in Chico at knife point, and his name just sort of indicated that he was, Trey in French means very. He was kind of too much of everything. He was a very beautiful young man. And he was so moved by being a night flower and by poetry, he began to write. And this is something he wrote. He wrote, and this was, again, one of the practices I like to do is where I come from. Because we come from places much more mysterious than, say, Oroville or Reading. And he wrote, I come from the soul of fire. My heart says there are rings of chances. My soul is suddenly traveling in the lights of time. It seems like my soul is visiting a place it has never been before. And that's when I kind of got the idea that maybe I could use nonviolent communication techniques, the basic tenets of nonviolent communication are, I feel because I need, would you be willing? And so I kind of had them structure poems around this new way of speaking. And Trey wrote, I feel like late afternoon light. I am a flight of thunder canyons. And then I had them write, Bring me an Arctic snow goose on its flight home. Would you be willing to call another breathtaking spring day of rain and snow? We could take a sleepwalk on the clouds. Now, this child is clearly a poet. And clearly, to me, that's what is missing from his life. He has no way to express himself. That's why he sobbed that first day. He was beginning to see an avenue. And some of these other kids wrote things like, bring me an award-winning ground where stars appear. Would you be willing? Would you be willing to ask who I am? Here's another. Would you be willing to be a king? Because I need small rivers to drink. And the other thing in workshops is I've learned that I don't care what level the kids are supposed to be. They want the highest literature. There's a poem by Vicente Huidobro called Ars Poetica. And excuse my Spanish. He goes, Que el verso sea como una llave, que abra mil puertas. And the kids love this. Let poetry be like a key opening a thousand doors. So that's Juvenile Hall kids. Many of them are poets. They're the rebels. They can't conform.
Yes, and as I was listening to those deep poems from these, and I want to say children, from these young people, I'm thinking of several things. One is that writing can help us heal. Would you agree with that?
Well, you know, again, that experience I had when I had my flip out had me shift my focus in the world from being an academic to being someone who was healing herself. And I found that most art forms, I started with ceramics, and I think you might have done ceramics, the act of centering a pot, the act of working with clay. And I think actually writing poetry is probably the most healing art form I've discovered. And there's even a group called the Poetry Therapy Group, and I spoke in Cleveland to that group, and I realized that essentially that's what we're doing here is a form of poetry therapy, even in Poets in the Schools. And yes, I would say it's healing, and I've had kids in the juvenile hall that were suicidal, that I was told afterwards that stopped being suicidal after, excuse me, after they began to write.
And you mentioned about pottery, and in my relation to that, I dated a potter, a ceramicist.
Uh-huh.
And he drove me deep into poetry.
Interesting. I love it.
It helped me get my emotions out. And in terms of, what was the term of the group that you said in Chicago? Or was it Chicago that you just mentioned that you went to, and talked to a group? It was a huge.
It was in Cleveland actually.
Sorry.
I think the whole group is something. They're poetry therapists, and there's a name for it. But it's a wonderful organization.
Well, that notion that poetry can be therapy and can help us heal. And when you were reading some of the work by Trey. I mean, that is very, very deep. I mean, in terms of what he was either consciously or unconsciously getting in touch with, you know, a soul of fire, a soul traveling. I mean, that really
and the
is,
rings of fire, yeah. And you see, he got those words. Like, I think rings of fire might have been one of the word tickets, or maybe not that one. I try not to have too many phrases, but rings, second chances, and then, you know, people say, well, you're giving us the words, but no two people put the words together ever in the same way, and we need more words. I've seen in so many workshops, in fact, my current favorite book to bring into my workshops, believe it or not, is Finnegan's Wake. And I don't care what level or what age, everyone loves James Joyce when they don't have to figure him out, when they hear the words. That man was playing Romeo and Juliet or Jolio and Ramoon. Amsterdam is Dampsterdamp. And the kids just love James Joyce. One boy in Calusa, I had to actually pull the book out of his hands. He was desperate to keep that book. And it completely transformed the way he wrote. We are starving for larger vocabulary.
So
is my experience.
I think what I would like to do now, if it's okay with you, is that there are two directions in which we can go, and we are going to take a break very shortly. One is that I would like to hear, and I know our audience would like to hear, just a series of your poems that you could read for us. And then I want to ask you about Jack Maybe, because you have dedicated Poem Crazy. It says, for my children, Daniel and Elizabeth, and for my teacher, Jack Maybe, who... wherever you are. And there's an interesting story that goes along with that. So we're going. This is Late Night Poetry Jam on KKRN 88.5. I am Pamela Spoda, poet and host, along with Doug Bennett, producer, and we have Susan Woolridge in the studio with us. And I have been meaning to say, but I forgot until this point, is that Susan dressed for radio. And We met caravanning up here to the studio, and she has this wonderful turquoise. It's a scarf shawl that goes around her neck that goes way down, and it's very, very beautiful, and also a turquoise dress. And she said that she did indeed dress for radio, and so I think that's wonderful.
Radio is a very visual thing for me, really.
So we've decided now that Susan is going to read. Simply going to read, and I'm not sure simply is the correct word, but she's going to read some of her poems. And she also said that she has one that's quite new that she's considering sharing with us. So I'm going to just let you read and read on.
Well, Pamela, should I start with the new one or should
sure.
I start with a driving poem? What do you think?
Why don't we start with the new
okay.
one?
Okay. This is actually a first draft, ladies and gentlemen, and one of the things that I like to do is take what I would consider a poem and I turn it into prose, because I've learned that sometimes we get kind of affected in our poetry, and it's nice to prose it And sometimes also it's nice to take a prose piece and kind of make it more like a poem in form, put some line breaks in, excuse me again, and that way we get rid of some of the excess. So this is actually a second draft, essentially a first draft. I got the idea that everything missing is still somewhere. And so this is called Everything Missing is Still Somewhere. And forgive me if it rambles, it is an early draft. Everything missing is still somewhere. My crystal sphere, one of dozens still rolling on the edge of a parking lot, if not lost in a plush couch that cradles a flock of contact lenses peeking somewhere glassy from a crevice of fabric. And all those keys, like soldiers stiff with purposeful duty, scattered hither and thither, spying through one eye on meandering pathways up long missing childhood knolls. Forget gloves and scarves littering lost and founds in a purgatory of tatted, bunched, fleecy, knobby knit. Those glasses crunched somewhere, crouching in bushes, needed, indeed, to find themselves, as if they could twist and turn inward, conspire, speak, call out creaking, here, here, from cockeyed frames. Missing planes, boats gone missing, sons and daughters, all of them, all of us, children locked away, chained in closets, or wandering malls calling, Mommy, Mommy, Mommy. My car went missing. Well, yes, twice, and I heard it call on a full moon night from Modoc Street, where scallywags drag raced and ditched it. Missing books, missing pages, missing rings, lockets, charms, hearts, songs of the bluebirds, languages of the old soul, and blue-footed boobies, dodos, dingbats, hares, turtles, cockatoos, snakes in the sewer, dream alligators, creeping down neighbors' basement stairs. We have missing species, missing dolls, all out there somewhere, even the lightning missing in smoke, the mountain missing in storm, the climbers, our climbers avalanched, only a few buckle clues, laces, not even shoes. All those missing names, missing even the name of the woman's mind gone missing, like the chime of a bell with a clapper dropped off long ago. It's all soon to be missing, isn't it, you trickster night, my life in a fog, time, days and nights missing. What of it? Highway patrols, search and rescue, lighthouses, you can have them all, thank you. I love you, thank you, I love you. Miracles of love gone missing, or so we thought, or so we thought. Those fledgling brown creepers, the ibis, the cormorant, the sky-baffling sandhill cranes warbling through our veil of reason. Things disappear just out of sight somewhere, deeper in the drawer somewhere, dipping in the cosmos, planet-hopping, though God knows planets go missing in long-lost black holes. Too many closets, pits, wells, cracks, tunnels. More light, please. Beam your rays, dear heart mine of light. Reveal the calm, changeless center. Help us find it all. Reveal the mountain, at least, lost so long in thunder and fear. And the keys, please. The pricey push-button Volkswagen keys, damn it. So that's new, and I realized as I was reading it, it needs cutting. It needs work, but... It's just fun to let yourself go on an early draft.
So were you thinking about the theme of it, or were you looking for something that was missing? One of the parts that really caught my eye had to do with glasses. You know, that you would need that they were looking for themselves. You know, here I am, and so you lost an object.
Oh, my gosh. I got to the point where the only way I could go anywhere was wearing sunglasses because they were my only prescription thing left. And I was driving back from the bay in the dark wearing sunglasses. And that was one of my worst driving moments because I was blind. It was crazy. And so, yes, I've lost. Now I got 3 new pairs at Costco, so I can't run out of glasses for a while. And I have extra contact lenses. It's a dilemma, not having eyes, not being able to see.
That is true. That is so true.
But I do lose things all the time. But then I was just thinking, they're still somewhere. They know where they are, maybe. So,
well, you mentioned You just mentioned driving, and that kind of leads us into, because you do write and drive, and you have driving poems. And so, could we hear?
I thought because we're at the moment very near Mount Shasta, that I'd read one. And I use this sometimes in workshops because I like to encourage people in their own writing to go far out with metaphor. In fact, there's a Stanley Kunitz poem where he says, "And the moon or the sun was nailed like an orange to his brow." And I just thought, this isn't a very famous poem. In a writing workshop, that would never last. It would be cut. The sun was nailed like an orange to his brow. And we're afraid to go far out. And so this is a poem of Mount Shasta where I allowed myself to go far out. And I was driving. I was approaching Redding, as I believe, as I wrote this poem. Shasta. Two looming trucks warn me of the mountain, but that cold, pale chin is matchless. Humans compete with snively road signs, flashing Florsheim shoe signs as the mountain's chiseled skull becomes larger. Shasta, mysterious sky whale, fragile as a brittle sand dollar underfoot. House of sky, shell, tooth, blade of grass sucked white, sun-bleached iguana spine. You white knee, struck with fright, lightning prayer, ghost thought. You sheet over the moon's mast, parsnip-carved heart. You heaven hung upside down, cold as the speed of light, all hidden under terror powder. But don't gloat. You don't scare me, Shasta. Not until I see your small, dark baby, Black Butte's nasty snout. Merciless as quicksand, pumice avalanche, parched cinder cone, like the tipped-up head of a king cobra, tongue forked to spit. The sun retreats, but Shasta, you still catch light on gladiator shanks, not one shadow even on your retinue of foothills. You're silent as the world sets me up to speak into microphones without a word to say. I've lost my mountain voice, my hangman's whoop, my cinder cone slur. Fill me, Shasta, with your heat, your cold. I'll be still. Slip your spellbound song through me. I neglected to say I'm terrified of heights. And sometimes when I go by Shasta, I get frightened. I just know she's going to blow. She's going to blow. And it seems like it's such hubris on our part to have put roads so close, especially Black Butte. We're literally on Black Butte's shoulder. The nerve of us. And I just don't quite understand why we're so close. And I've always been afraid of heights and mountains. I love them. It's a love-hate relationship. So...
Well, humans certainly do have a lot of nerve in terms of where they build, where they go.
Yeah, absolutely.
The Magic Mountain, though, that's a wonderful, Mount Shasta is such a wonderful mountain.
I love it.
The magical.
It's so amazing.
The magic of it. And I do want to say, just for our listeners, because they're not here and they can't appreciate this, if you get poets together, you should see our table in front of us and the stool beside us. And if you hear rustling papers, it's because we have so many. We have so many poems and information that we can read. And it's really wonderful and beautiful. And it looks like you're holding two in front of you.
Well, a couple more driving poems. And actually, this one... Driving west, I wasn't driving, which is unusual, but I was with my family. We were driving west, and I started imagining the way I did as a child, that I was running alongside the car on a horse. Has anyone ever done that? Horse lovers do that. You gallop along. And so this is just a short one about driving west. And then I'm going to read one more short one that I wrote actually while driving, called Heading Home to Chico. driving west, through the town of 10 Sleep, 10 days walking, or 4 nights on Spook and Foxy, galloping through Emigrant, Miner, Prey, Wyoming, and Deserted Opportunity. With plastic orange water in Martha's Heidi milk bowl, skimming wide valleys, counting up the fat men in the streets of Anaconda, sluice tailings, copper mines, Copernicus basking in all that big sky above the Whitehall Cafe, where big-bellied ranchers gather in hats for biscuits and gravy, as we head on toward Bear Mouth, Beaver Tail, and Crazy Woman Canyon. I guess that one's about names. I love names of things. And on the way here, I'm going to rattle some papers, guys. On the way here, I was just jotting down names. Between Chico and Redding, there's Dairyville, Electric Avenue, there's Bray Avenue, there's Cone Grove Road. I can't even read my writing, but I just especially love Bray Avenue. Someone must have had a donkey on that road.
And I too, my eye catches with, is it Electric Avenue?
Yeah.
And it just kind of pulls me in, and my truck in the past broke down there, and I had an old dog, not Mambo, my Akita, but an older dog. So we got out of my truck, and we were looking for someone to help us, pull us out of the mud, as a matter of fact, right off of Electric Avenue.
See, and I want her to make that into a poem that starts with, an old dog, not Mambo, my Akita, and then a poem about Electric Avenue with Mambo in it. Hey, Mambo, Mambo Italiano.
Oh, so, can I say one thing about
this is wide open.
Thank you. About horses, and you had mentioned that about galloping along, and I don't know whether it's a girl thing or whether it can be a boy thing too, but I remember as a child that I loved horses. My cousin had horses, and I would pretend I was a horse. See, I'm saying this on the air, and I would gallop through the almond orchards. But, and I think this has to do with creativity, my mother would say, you need to stop that because people are going to think you're wacko. They're going to think you're nuts. And I thought, oh, but I was so free and wild and running, and it was wonderful. But, oh, well.
You know, our mothers try to control us. My dear friend Tana, and maybe she'll hear this, and I'm not sure that's a good or bad thing, but her mother said to her once, you walk like a man. And she was young, and she lost the ability to walk. She got so self-conscious about her walking, she never felt comfortable walking again. And our mothers try to help us. I mean, my mother said, she put me in a little panty girdle. I think I weighed 90 pounds. And she said, you know, jiggling isn't ladylike or something. And so, of course, I took up African dance much later. But our moms, they're trying to protect us, I think. You know, but yeah, you were a horse. I think I have a chapter in Fool's Gold about that. It's called Being a Horse.
Oh.
It's a chapter 33. So when you read it, you'll enjoy that one.
Oh, okay, good. Do you have another driving poem for us?
Yeah, this one is heading back into Chico, and it was midnight, and I just noticed the beauty of the glow of our town as I approached. So it's just a short one called Heading Home. Heading home in a late night spring storm, that soft, flat northeast glow becomes Chico, our town, bidding me home like a lantern, hushed little midnight sunset, blushing bedroom eyes, low and sweet like a rain song. Bayless Blue Gum, Ord Ferry, River Road, shiny night paths home where clouds rush like smoky fields on fire, and the Dayton sheriff car pokes out like an alligator snout to slow down trespassers like me. Mother's Four Corners naps near silhouettes of night trees like tall thoughts brewing in patches of tule fog in the glow of our electrical rose quartz city, where lights click out one by one and we slip to sleep, unaware we are each bathed in our own radiance. Unaware we are each bathed in our own radiance. I was part of a little jazz group, and I was the spoken word part, and I sort of began repeating little parts of poems sometimes. It's a little bit affected, but it's fun.
Well, I do like the repetition, though. I because I use that in my poetry.
All right, girl. But yeah, we should read together sometime.
We should. Slipped to sleep. I mean, I noticed that in your last poem too, with the bees, the wonderful bee sounds that you had, and slipped to sleep. I really like that.
Thank you. Yeah.
Now I'm going to bring up a person's name.
Girl.
And I remember when we were chatting about this, I was just kind of, I don't know, mystified would be the right word. It was just so intriguing to me that as part of your dedication in Poem Crazy was this to Jack Mabey, a teacher that you had in elementary school or high school, and you really didn't know him at that time, but he must have read the foreword to this book. Jack Mabey. Oh, that's me. No, that's just what I'm remembering. And that he contacted you or somehow.
It happened even more mysteriously than that.
But can I say one more thing?
Sure.
But what I remember is, as you were telling me about this person that was inspirational in many ways, that, I mean, he was a man of opposites. I mean, really opposites. And that's the feeling that I'm left with. So go ahead.
Well, he was a Gemini. Yeah, it's interesting. And this, again, was my mother. I was just going to dedicate it to Jack Mabey because I realized when I traced Poem Crazy back to the beginning that it came from this teacher that I had when I was 13 years old at the University of Chicago Laboratory School. And he was a student there, and he was an absolute outlaw. And it is dedicated to my children, Daniel and Elizabeth, and for my teacher, Jack Mabey, wherever you are. And at one point I thought of writing, "If you read this, Jack, please write." But there were whisperings about his past. He was pretty scandalous as a person. And yet he taught essentially what amounts to freedom literature. He brought us Cyrano de Bergerac, and we had to memorize parts of it. And I remember memorizing, "Magnificent my nose, you pug. You knob, you buttonhead. Know that a nose indicates a great man such as I and such as you, poor wretch, would never dare to be even in your imagination." Should I keep going? "For that face, that vain, inglorious concavity which my right hand finds on top of you is devoid of pride, of poetry, of soul, of picturesqueness, of nose, in short, is that which at the end of that limp spine of yours..." My left foot. Anyway, this was Jack, and he introduced Emily Dickinson, Walt Whitman, D.H. Lawrence. I found myself at the age of 14, I was very short. My head barely reached up to the counter of Woodworth Bookstore buying Lady Chatterley's Lover. And, I think we all had crushes on this man. He was wild. He would let us get away with anything if we could make him laugh. And so we did these interesting little makeup reports. I wrote one about a page in the dictionary, in the encyclopedia, after the page of the topic I was supposed to be writing about. Little Carol Murray gave him a paper that was the size of a thimble that was in a giant box. He loved play, and he was kind of a genius. Here's a little paragraph about him from my chapter, Mr. Mabey. "Jack Mabey was short, buff, and cocky. He had a blonde, bristly crew cut and a smart-ass grin. He wore black frame glasses sometimes and sunglasses sometimes. It was the 60s. Mr. Mabey claimed he wore shades because he couldn't stand the glare of our bright, shiny faces. He was hip." And he called me Susie Goldsmith in a school packed with Sues. Now, I had not seen him since that time. And the miracle was that he, sort of a recluse, he doesn't go to bookstores. And it turns out one of his ex-women, who he had Henry Higgins'd along, was an editor for Booklist. And Poem Crazy was sent to her to review. And instead of reviewing it, she said, "Oh, my God, this is dedicated to my Jack, Mr. Mabey." And so she sent him the book. Now, had she reviewed it instead, my life would be very different. But she sent it to Jack. My marriage had just ended. And he claims he fell in love with the woman who wrote the book. And he wrote me the most amazing letter. And it just started, Dear Susie Goldsmith. Susie Goldsmith is just one word as any fool can plainly see. Seems to me knowing the difference between one and two words is central to something or other. He just sort of went on and on. And we met and we became went into this crazy love. And he was in his 60s and I was in my 50s. And unfortunately, he was just a little too far over the edge for me. And so we couldn't stay together, but we still talk a lot. And he saved my life twice. So he saved it when I was 13, 14 by... He had us read the Diary of Anne Frank, and my mother's maiden name was Frank. I'm Jewish, and he had us start a diary, and he had us do it in the form Anne did it as letters to a friend. And I wrote to Dear Dottie. Anne wrote to Dear Kitty, and my very first sentence is, Dear Dottie, I've never had a diary before. I hope I can keep this one up. Knowing me, probably not. And I never expected to keep it up, but it became my life. And Jack informed it. So.
Well, I know that in your chapbook, Bathing with Ants, that you have a poem on page 29. It's called Hail Bop.
Uh-oh.
And you said this was related to Jack maybe in some way. And when I think of Hail Bop, I think of all those people covered with black blankets drinking poison because they're going to meet the comet flying through the sky. But this is not where your poem goes.
No, though interestingly, Jack lived very close to the house in which that happened in Encinitas. Very close. He looked out over Rancho Santa Fe. I believe that's where it happened. No, I was just ignoring that because I like to ignore things that give me a lot of pain. And that came out from that early experience. So this is called Hail Bop. Coming is like a comet, you say, light moving in all that dark. And in the wild, Hail Bop fills the sky from head to tail like a bridal trail poking at the order of the heavens, then slips into the leafy arms of the oak. Reticent as a hermit with his lantern, she coaxes us out into the night, tentative with tiny lights, leading heaven knows where.
Susan, I think we have time to hear several more poems from you, and this has just been wonderful. And so what would you like to read to us next?
First, I just want to say what fun it's been being reunited with you, Pamela, and being in this little radio lookout. It's kind of like a lookout tower. Well, Pamela was saying she loved the blind tour guide, and that was just part of a group gathering at Upper Crust, and we would come up with funny titles and someone would choose a line from something. And so that's where this one came from. And it's so goofy. I love the idea of a blind tour guide. And here we go.
See, I thought it was true.
Well, you know, maybe there was a headline about a true story, but no.
Okay.
Well, you know, it's true in the mystical realm. Let's put it that way.
And I thought, how clever, how interesting. The blind tour guide can see better than those with eyes.
Well,
that's
what this is about, but I love that you thought it was true. The blind tour guide taps across Puerto Rico until the red tip of the white cane hits ocean. Here, he declares, we have a beach. I'm on the blind tour. It's been going on forever. Tomorrow in Venezuela, we'll walk into buildings, sing in Espanol, and dance till we bump in the dark. We shut our eyes and hold the coattails of our blind guide, sure as a compass, striding into jungle, never grazing one winged bug.
Oh, I really like that.
I should probably end with that one.
Thank you so much, Susan, for being with us this evening. You, the audience, can check out her books, Poem Crazy, Bathing with Ants, and Fool's Gold. Our next show will be January 25th, 2014, and we will be focusing on poems of revolution and social consciousness. So please tune in.